Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in his condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" There's a lot that we don't know. We don't know when it happened. We don't know how it happened. What we do know is that this guy has not been able to walk for a long time. 38 years, to be exact. That's a long time to have to use your arms to drag the dead weight of your legs around. That's a long time to wait for other people to lift up the pallet and carry you so you can move someplace else. It was sometime during those 38 years that he began to come to this pool called Bethesda. It was a rather large pool. It was located outside of the Sheep Gate leading up to Jerusalem. It was surrounded by five covered porches. But the most important thing about the pool was its reputation for healing. Rumor had it that if you were the first person to get into the pool when the water was stirring, you would be healed. That's why he came to the pool. But let's be honest, his chances of being healed were like zero. He didn't have the ability to lower himself into the pool. By his own admission, he didn't have anybody around who would help him get into the pool. And do you really think that the pool had the power to make him well? I don't. It was probably some kind of mineral springs that had the power to work with sore joints or an aching back. But it's not a pool that had the power to heal crippled legs. This guy is alone. He's helpless. He's hopeless. That's his everyday normal. I wonder if that describes someone that you know. Maybe you think, yeah, I know someone who really doesn't have a close friend, someone who doesn't feel like they have very much power to kind of cope with the circumstances of life. They don't have a future. Maybe some of you here this morning say, you're actually talking about how I feel sometime. Well, his normal is about to change. We read that Jesus went up to Jerusalem because of one of the Jewish festivals. And when Jesus got to Jerusalem, he went to the pool of Bethesda and he began to look around. And he watched the dozens of people there, some blind, some just kind of hobbling around, some lying there. But then his eyes fixed on this man. Maybe it's because Jesus knew that of all the people there, he was the least likely to be able to get into the pool. But Jesus goes over and speaks to him, and the next thing you know it, he's walking. After 38 years, he has a new normal. Now that's what Jesus does. Jesus changes situations. Jesus gives us a new normal. And at first glance, it might seem like the normal that Jesus brought to this man was his healing. And Jesus certainly did that. But I think there's something even more that Jesus does for this man, or potentially does for him. John chapter 5 is divided into two parts. The first part records this incredible miracle. The second part is a rather long, complex explanation where Jesus explains why he did the miracle and what it says about him. And if we're going to understand the new normal that Jesus offers to us, we really have to dig into that second part. And what we're going to see is that Jesus offers us the very life of God himself. We're going to go through this chapter in kind of three sections. First, we're going to look at verse 6 and some verses around it. Then we're going to look at verses 12 through 14, and then the end of the chapter, verses 39 through 40. And what we're going to see at the beginning is healing, and then forgiveness, and then God's life. But these are like steps. They kind of build on each other. And it's not until you get to the last step that you really understand what it is that Jesus offers to us. So with that in mind, let's continue with John chapter 5. I'm at verse 6. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. When I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." Isn't it interesting that Jesus asked this man the question, "Do you want to get well?" Duh. I mean, it's been 38 years. Of course he wants to get well, doesn't he? But more than anyone else, Jesus understands the human heart. And Jesus knows that not everyone who's sick really does want to get well, because sometimes getting well means you have to give up stuff that you like about being sick. Let's say that a man has a very explosive temper. He says, I need help. I need to get well. But deep down inside, he really doesn't want to give up the sense of control and power that he has when he explodes. Think of a teenager who is struggling with different kinds of addictions and says, I want to get well. But deep inside, they really don't want to give up the feeling that they have or the friends that they do their addiction with. Not everyone who says, I want to get well, wants to get well. That's why Jesus asked the question. But maybe he's going in a slightly different direction. Maybe what Jesus is saying is, do you really believe that this pool has the power to make you well? Because Jesus knows that as human beings, sometimes we trust things to make us well. Sometimes we trust things to make us happy that don't have the power to do that. And so we think to ourselves, if I just had more money, if I just had a new house, if I was just married. And then we get more money, and we get a new house, and we get married. And we understand, as good as those things are, they really don't have the power to bring us the happiness that we thought they did. Sometimes the pools just can't make us well. Has anyone here ever heard of Tom Brady? Kids, anybody heard of Tom Brady? Tom Brady is the quarterback for the Cleveland Browns, right? No, yes, oh, we wish. Okay. No, he is not. Tom Brady is the quarterback for the New England Patriots, okay? Yeah, and he, no chance now. That's all next week, okay? Okay. When I'm in Mexico, you guys can do whatever you want to up here. But he is one of the great quarterbacks to ever play the game, without a doubt, whether you like him or not. And a couple of weeks ago, I saw a video that involved Tom Brady where he was interviewed on 60 Minutes. Now, this is an older video because at that time he'd only won 3 Super Bowl rings, and I think today he's won 5, if I'm not mistaken. Next week will be, okay, I don't want to be a prophet. Thank you, Lauren. Who invited you in here today? Yeah, okay. Next week will be, okay. So, but what I want to do is to show you a little bit of the clip. We apologize that it's an old video. It's not perfectly synced up, but I want you to hear what he has to say.
It's what you always wanted.
You're right. It has. And I didn't think it came with all the other baggage, though.
In addition to his success on the field and his sex appeal off it, there is also the $60 million 10-year contract to play with the Patriots.
I mean, I'm making more money now than I ever thought I could ever make playing football.
But with all that money, fame, and career accomplishments, we were surprised to hear this from him.
Why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey, man, this is what it is. I reached my goal, my dream, my life is me. I thank God. It's got to be more than this.
What's the answer?
I wish I knew.
3 Super Bowl rings. It's got to give you everything you want, right? Maybe not. It says, hey, there's got to be something more than this. And so this man is waiting at a pool to be healed that doesn't have the power to heal him. And then Jesus comes along and gives him a healing that he never could have dreamed of. And we're told that at once the man was cured. This is verse 9. He picked up his mat and walked. I love what the great Swiss preacher Walter Luther says about this. He says, there is almost something of a divine humor in this command of the Lord. As if he wished to say something like, change places now. It, referring to the map, has carried you long enough. Now you carry it for a change. More or less as a dentist gives a child its extracted tooth in a little box so that it can take it home and triumphantly show it off as the defeated scoundrel who caused so much pain. You carry the mat. Show off what I've done for you. And so Jesus brings about healing. Here we see Jesus as the helper, and friends, he's still that. When we go through problems, he is there to help us, whether it's a financial problem or a relational problem or some kind of thing that we're struggling with inside or even health problems. He's there to help. But this passage goes on and talks about more. I mean, verses 12 through 14. So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him well. So what we learn is that later in the day, this man who'd been healed went up to the temple. And I imagine he's feeling great going up there. He's got kind of a bounce in his step, and he's hopping around a little bit. He said, "Man, I can walk. This is wonderful." In his mind, everything is good. We also read that later in the day, Jesus goes up to the temple. And when Jesus is at the temple, he sees the man. And they have a conversation, maybe a long conversation, but the writer of John or the gospel only records a short little bit. And Jesus is not thinking that everything is good for this man. In fact, Jesus gives him a warning. Verse 14, he says, "See, you are well. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." Now, this raises a number of questions for us. But it's obvious that this man, or Jesus, still thinks that this man has an unresolved sin problem. And he needs to take care of that problem, or something worse than even 38 years of being crippled is going to happen to him. Well, what is the problem, or what is that something worse that could possibly be in store? I think it's found in verse 29, later, when Jesus gives the explanation. And beginning at verse 28, he says, "Do not be amazed at this. For a time is coming when all who are in their graves will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done what is good will rise to life. Those who have done what is evil will rise to be condemned," or will rise to judgment. The something worse is judgment. Dallas Willard, before his death, taught philosophy at the University of Southern California. Now, if you're going to teach philosophy, you have to be smart. And if you're going to teach at the University of Southern California, you have to be very smart. Dallas Willard was. But he was also a very committed follower of Jesus. He wrote a lot of books, and he talked a lot. And I remember in more than one place either hearing him say or reading something that he read, "Do you understand that you are an eternal spiritual being? Do you understand that you are an eternal spiritual being?" Think about that. If you and I are only temporary physical beings, that means that all we have to do is live for this life. It means that we can party our lives away under the banner, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But if we are spiritual beings, that means we were created for something more, for higher purpose, for God. And if we're eternal, it means that one day we'll be face to face with God. And Jesus says that when that happens, it's either going to be a resurrection of life or it's going to be a resurrection of judgment. And it depends on whether how we've lived. And so he said, those who've done evil will go to the resurrection of judgment. That's why Jesus tells this man, stop sinning, so that something worse doesn't happen to you. What Jesus doesn't tell him is that you don't have the power to do that. Jesus just warns of the problem. The solution is found later. And the solution is actually found about verse 23 and kind of going on from there. And in verse 23, Jesus talks about honoring the Son. The solution is the Son of God. And we begin to experience his forgiveness when we honor him. You see, what Jesus makes very clear as we read through the explanation is that God has arranged things in such a way so that Jesus is the solution for our sin. Just as a brilliant doctor might kind of come across or make a medicine that is the cure for a horrible disease, so God has worked in such a way that Jesus is the cure for our disease of sin. We can't cure ourselves, but God has made it possible for us to be cured in Jesus. That's why Jesus took on human flesh. That's why Jesus lived a perfect life. That's why he went to a cross at the end of his life to pay a penalty for our sins. And in this passage, Jesus says, honor the Son. Honor the Son. Nowhere in John 5 do we read that this man did that. Nowhere in John 5 do we read that this man who'd been healed ever believed in Jesus. He seems to have been eager to receive the physical healing that Jesus brought, but he wasn't quite as eager to get his life right with God. And friends, I've seen that so often. I don't know how many times over the years when I've seen someone in a moment of crisis come and just call out to God and say, Pastor, would you pray for me? I need help. And then the crisis is resolved, and all of a sudden, they're just kind of walk away from everything. Jesus essentially says, make sure that the sin problem is addressed so that you don't face a much bigger problem. And so what we see is that Jesus comes to help this man with his problem, and then Jesus says, okay, make sure that you take care of the bigger problem, it's your sin. But now we come to the very end, and in verses 16 through 18, and then at the end of the section, we'll read this. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. In his defense, Jesus said to them, my Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working. For this reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. So what we've learned is that Jesus did this miracle on the Sabbath day. Now, for the Jews, you didn't do any work at all on the Sabbath day, period. No physical labor. For Jesus to heal the man was a violation of the Sabbath. For the man to pick up his mat and carry it was a violation of the Sabbath. The Jewish leaders got mad at Jesus. That's why we read in verse 16, they were ready to persecute him. You know what Jesus does with that? It's like he pours a little gasoline on their anger. And he says that my Father is always at work, and I am working too. Now, here's what he's saying by this. Doesn't the sun come up on the Sabbath? And doesn't it rain on the Sabbath? And aren't babies born on the Sabbath? And isn't God involved in all of those things? You see, my Father is always at work. He's doing good even on the Sabbath. I'm simply doing what my Father is doing. Well, when they heard that, they were really, really angry because they understood that Jesus was not only calling God his Father, but he was making himself equal with God. Jesus doesn't deny it. He owns it. And if we could spend some time going through verses 19 through 35, we'd kind of talk about a lot of complicated things. But let me make the complicated themes really, really simple. This is what I think Jesus says in John 5, 19 through 35. Jesus began by simply says, the Father and I are one. We are equal. Verse 21 says, "For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son gives life to whom he's pleased to give it." So the Father and the Son both give life. Even though the Son is equal to the Father, out of love for his Father, he chooses to submit and says, "Not my will, but your will be done." So verse 30, he says, "I seek not to please myself, but him." Think of that as kind of a wall. God's behind the wall. The Father's behind the wall. In verse 37, Jesus says, "You have never seen his voice nor seen his form." In other words, because of sin, you're not able to, in a sense, experience God. But what does the Father do? The Father sends the Son. He sends the Son into the world, and what does the Son do? He comes and he brings life. You'll get an explanation of the bucket in just a little bit. And so what Jesus is saying is, "I'm one with the Father, but I have been sent by the Father into the world so that you could experience the life of the Father." In verses 39 and 40, he says, "You search the scriptures because you think that in the scriptures you have life, but you don't realize that they bear witness to me, but you don't come to me so that you can have life." And the Jewish leaders did search the scriptures a lot. They had all kinds of thoughts about him, and they had made all kinds of rules about the scriptures, and they tried to live their lives by the scriptures. But Jesus said, "You know what? Don't you understand that these point to me? They point to me so that you would come to me, and if you would come to me, you would experience life." Now, I hope you guys get as excited about this as I am. But let me share with you something that I kind of rediscovered this week that just was so meaningful to me. In the Gospel of John, there are two primary words that are used for life. One is psuche, one is zoe. Psuche refers to physical life. Zoe refers to this wonderful life. I'm going to call it God's life. So in John chapter 10, verse 15, Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd. I lay down my life for the sheep." He's using the word psuche. He's saying, "I lay down my body, my physical life, for the sake of the sheep." But in John chapter 10, verse 10, when Jesus says, "I have come that you might have life and have it to the full," he's not using the word psuche. He's not talking about a long physical life. He's using the word zoe. He's saying, "I've come so that you could experience the very life of God." In John 3:16, the word that you find for life is the word zoe. Now, let me add something to it. There's an adjective that typically is used with the word zoe. It's hardly ever used with the word psuche for physical life, but it's often used with the word zoe for God's life. You know what that adjective is? John 3:16, what kind of life? Eternal, okay? The adjective is eternal. You know what eternal means? Probably the best definition of it is eternity now. Eternity is an adjective that says that the life that is in the future with God has become present here and now. And so what Jesus is saying is that I've come that to bring you the very life of God. I've come that you could experience eternity now. Now, I don't know how to illustrate that, so I was trying to think about it this week, and this is the best I can come up with, so I hope it works for you. This is an eyedropper. This is a bucket. The best that we experience in human life comes like in eyedropper forms. So love, little eyedropper. Joy, little eyedropper. Peace, I'll give you two drops of that. Eyedropper size. Compassion, eyedropper. This is human life. This is the life that Jesus has come to bring. This is God's life. This is eternity now. Love, it comes in a bucket. And this bucket ought to be a whole lot bigger. Joy, it's like a bucket. Peace is a bucket. Compassion is a bucket. Power is a bucket. And he's come to share it. I thought of filling it with confetti, but I didn't. Come to share it with us now. Now, we only begin to experience the buckets when we're with God in eternity. But because Jesus has come and brought the life of God, eternity now, into our everyday lives, we can experience a whole lot more than an eyedropper. And that's why the New Testament talks about grace upon grace. It talks about a peace that passes all understanding. It talks about the same power that raised Jesus from the dead. It talks about a joy that just can't be contained. Jesus comes to bring us the life of God. He comes to bring us eternity now. Friends, that's 180 degrees different from what the man at the beginning of John chapter 5 experiences. It's a life that's marked by God's love and empowerment and hope. And it's real, and it's still changing lives today. And at this point, I'd like to invite Lizette Sundvik up, and she's going to share a little bit of her story with you.
Good morning. I am Lizette Sundvik. I have written about this, I have talked many times about this, and I get 3.5 minutes. So what I want to focus on is when I was first growing up and I was raised Roman Catholic, I knew a little bit about Jesus, but I didn't have relationship. And when I went to college, I learned a little bit more about Jesus because somebody witnessed to me, and I started to go to Campus Crusade. But that whole issue about submission, yeah, that wasn't for me either. So I didn't have that either. One of the things that I was defined by prior to my meeting Jesus and really knowing who he was and is was ambition. And in the course of that ambition, my husband George and I met, and I'd graduated college and I moved to San Diego and he followed me and I went to law school. And you want to talk about ambition? There's probably no other area that will force you to be ambitious to stay part of that group. And after I graduated and we both moved to Las Vegas and we both had our own sense of ambition, it wasn't easy. George and I are both very dominant type people and vying and overcoming a lot of things. And as I went into the field of law, in 1 year of opening a practice in 1995, by 96, I had bought a building. And the day before I bought that building, I found out I was pregnant. Most people would pause, but not me. I moved forward and bought that building. We got married. We had our first child. And within 2 weeks of having that child, I was back in the courtroom. This is a person who is ambitious and will not ask for help from anybody else. By March of 98, I was 30 years old, and I was diagnosed as permanently, partially disabled with fibromyalgia. At this point in my life, my health was zero. It was negligible. My mental state was fragmented. My emotional state was overwhelmed. My physical state obviously depleted. My spiritual state, not even thought of. In June of 98, I started with the one area that I felt I could start with, and that was finances. And I went to a financial counselor, and she just happened to be a Christian. I now don't believe in coincidences in life. She listened to my story. She pushed everything aside, and she said, "Lizette, I have to tell you something. You need God, and you need him really bad." It's okay to laugh. I did. And within a few days, I was in church, sitting by her side, listening to a very interesting and life-changing sermon about priorities. If there had not been another person in that room, that sermon that day was preached to me personally. God reached down and touched my heart and showed me what a relationship with Jesus meant and what it looked like. And it certainly wasn't the life that I was living at that time, because I was a workaholic. I was working at times 10 to 12 hours a day, even though I was sick. And we had a child. And you could imagine that wasn't easy on the people around me. When I met Jesus that day, I started on the journey to figure out who he was, because I'm a lawyer. And now I've put my faith in something other than myself, and I don't even know what that meant. So I did research, because that's what lawyers do. I read the Bible. I read Lee Strobel. I went and talked to people around me who I trusted to answer my questions. I joined study groups. But most of all, I prayed. I journaled. I put my thoughts down and I looked at them. And in the course of 5 years, literally engaging a very intense process of what do I believe, letting go, letting God, and not just being Pollyanna about that, my life changed. In those 5 years, the fibromyalgia lifted. This is a condition, folks, that out of 38 symptoms, I had 37. It's told to me that it's an irreversible condition, and it lifted over that time. I went back out into an office environment. In the meantime, we had had a second child, but I had the luxury, I had the blessing of being able to stay home, work from home during the birth of that second child. And when that second child went into kindergarten, it was time. And I went out into an office atmosphere, into a new area of law that built up in estate planning instead of tearing down in divorce. And 18 years later, a marriage that nobody thought ever would work, we are thriving. We have two well-adjusted children. And most of all, when things fall apart, because it's not all roses, we continue to go back to the core. We pray together. We pray individually. And we keep engaging the journey of who Jesus is in our lives and in my life. I don't know what God has in store for me as life goes on. I just know that it doesn't have to be as scripted as when I was a little girl. It doesn't have to be by default and just how I was raised. He has the power to come into my life and transform it then, and he can do it today, and he can do it in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lizette. He has the power to transform my life. And he does. You know, what we've seen in John chapter 5 is that Jesus comes to provide help, but to do more than provide help. That Jesus comes with an offer of forgiveness, but there's more than an offer of forgiveness. Jesus comes to make available the very life of God himself. And how is it that we receive that? Well, it begins when we honor Jesus. Honoring Jesus simply means that we believe who he is and what he's done. It means that we kind of turn our backs on our own self-centered way of living. We receive what he's done for us, and we begin to follow after him the best that we know how. The Bible says that when we make that decision, eternity now, God's life, comes into us through the Holy Spirit. And all of a sudden, there is a bucket that we can begin to draw on, where there's only been an eyedropper before. But in order to experience more and more, there needs to be a deepening relationship with Jesus. And that's what Lizette was talking about. It's interesting, when you go through the Gospel of John, Jesus uses a bunch of different metaphors to kind of make that clear. For example, in John 4, he talks about drinking from a well of living water. In John chapter 6, he talks about eating bread that doesn't perish. In John 15, talks about being a vine that abides, or branch that abides in the vine. And those talk about nearness and closeness and connectedness. Maybe the best way to think about it is simply as a friendship. To experience the life of God in increasing measure, we need to have a deepening friendship with the one who's come to bring it and who loves us. And my guess is that a lot of you here this morning know how to do that. It's not a question of maybe the next step that you need to take. It's just having the willingness to do that, making the time to do that, stepping out and doing it. If you're here today and you don't know what that next step is, any of us who are Dave, Ken, myself, those of us who are going to be praying on the side in just a minute, we just would love to talk with you about it a little bit more and help you. That's why we're here as a church. I don't know about you. I just get really, really excited, and I've been thinking about it all week, to say, my goodness, Lord, you love me, and there is so much that's available to me. I just need to learn how to drink it in increasing measure.